Hello, everyone. I'm Andrew Harrison, and welcome to a special edition of Big Mouth, the clue being in the intro music that we've just heard.
I'm Sian Pattenden. I've gone a bit art crazy this week. I'll have already done an art show by the time this comes out. Very exciting. But in the meantime, I've been listening to a lot of music. Funny that we've had a change from our usual menu of hot pop releases and new stuff on the telly. We have two very special guests with us. Electronic pop pioneers, probably the biggest band to come out of the Wirral on Merseyside. Smash It stalwarts back in the day, and inventors of one of the most remarkable dances ever seen on Top of the Pops. Now reunited, they're touring like mad and celebrating 40 years at the coalface of Bleep with a new box set and greatest hits, both called Souvenir. 5 CDs and 2 DVDs. It's enough to choke a horse. After many years in which many people perhaps thought of them as having gone too pop because they had the cheek to have hit and make videos, hooray, they're now appreciated as one of Britain's best electronic bands, as well as, on their day, proper art weirdos. It's Andy McCluskey and Paul Humphreys, a.k.a. Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark.
Hello, hey, lads. Hey. How are you?
Hello.
Good. Happy to be here.
There's 40 years between those two songs, Messages and Don't Go, and yet listeners will detect a bit of sonic continuity. These days, do you think, yes, we should sound like us?
Yes, we should sound like us. I mean, you know, we have...
At the end of the interview, can we go? That was easy.
No, I mean, you know, we have... Andy and I have a kind of a quirky way of writing songs, and we have our own unique way of doing things. And, you know, we can't avoid having our personal signatures on the songs, mm-hmm. and we have a certain way of doing things. So, yeah, it'll still sound like... Whatever we do now will still sound like OMD.
The so-called old analogue synth sound has become fashionable again for about 20 years now. Do you hear current synth bands and think, hang on, we were doing that years ago?
I think the in this postmodern era now where, you know, all popular culture is eating its own history, mm-hmm. You hear all sorts of things that are resonant of past styles and sounds. But it's, we hear stuff that sounds very much like, oh, yeah, no, that sounds a familiar sound. The only difference is the younger bands actually tend to be purists and they dig out the original analogue synths.
Whereas we used to use.
We hate them now because they never used to stay in tune. You couldn't sync them together and they weighed a ton. Okay. So we actually prefer the plugins now.
Oh, yeah, we sell our synths to them on eBay.
Fantastic. So you like knock them out on eBay with an original. We did message it on this one, you know, extra 20%. I saw you guys at Latitude a few years ago and you came on and said something along the lines, I can't remember the exact line, but it was like, so this is the Arty Festival, isn't it? Here we go, 15 top 20 singles, no B-sides. And you went straight in, hits all the way. You're about to embark on a 90% sold-out tour of Europe. Is it fun to be back in the old touring band mode again? You know, the idea of like... Because you spent a long time in the kind of the major label, 3 years between albums, lots of interviews, lots of sort of thinking about stuff. To be back doing it.
Yeah, I mean, we're back doing both things. Mm. I mean, you know, we've done... Since we got back together in 2005, we've made three albums.
Yeah.
But yeah, we love to play live. And as long as people want to come and... buy the tickets to come and see us. We'll, and as long as we've got the energy, we'll keep touring. You know, we love to play gigs.
We started as a live band. I mean, we invented Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark to play, admittedly, only one gig, but one gig at Eric's Club in Liverpool, and we had to work out how we were going to do it. And because basically our mates thought what we were doing was crap, it was just me and him and a tape recorder because nobody wanted to play with us. But we've always played live, and I think it's important to be able to do that. You know, I mean, writing the songs is the key element of what we do, but playing them live is crucially important.
Because you did have a few years off, a few years apart. When you're revisiting that, because it's an astonishing catalogue, it's like, what is it, there's 40 tracks on this Greatest Hits now, and even a condensed best of singles OMD thing is about 25, 30 tracks long. Do you look back on these songs and go, God, did we really do that? You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's only when you sort of put these compilation albums together and hear them as one that you think, yeah, that's quite a good body of work, that.
Some of the early ones, and I mean, Electricity we wrote when we were 16. So literally, they are like... I seem to vaguely recall the people who wrote that. Was it me? Yes, it actually was. I was a different person in those days. So it's a long journey of kind of being reacquainted with your own self from the past.
And when we got back together in 2005, we hadn't played these songs in sort of, I don't know, 12, 13 years or whatever. So we had to reacquaint ourselves with the songs. And in fact, in the rehearsal room, we just had a CD player. And we just kept hitting play going, well, is that an A? Is that a C? No, it's a G. Yeah. You know, just to re-remind ourselves.
There's also the art madness side of OMD, the Art Weirdo Radiophonic Workshop, Dazzleships Tape Experiments. This yeah. is Helena, ABC Auto Industries side, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But on the pop side, you've just been touring with the B-52s.
We
is
have,
that right?
And
how are
Berlin.
They?
And Berlin as well. So yeah. three, all celebrating their 40th anniversaries.
Good God. Yeah. How are the B-52s? Because that looks like it should be a fun thing to be on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
I mean, you know, people talk about bands who are iconic of a style or a genre. Well, the B-52s are just the B-52s. There is no genre like them.
They're their own genre.
They are a completely standalone band. So, you know, to hear so many of the tracks off their first album in particular, it was just fantastic to, you know, they've got all those quirky, bleepy organs and things and strangely tuned guitars and weird vocals. And it's just, it's great to still be hearing that live, which hopefully is what people think when they hear us playing the old stuff.
They must have played Eric's at some point. You must have seen them.
I didn't ask them if they did, actually.
I don't recall that they ever did. I'm going to have to go and look through my old handbills now, because if they did, we didn't see them.
No. Nah. We used to see most in the 70s, late 70s, mid to late 70s. We saw every band coming through Eric's, really. We were there all the time. From Devo to all kinds of bands.
Peru Boo, XTC, The Cure.
And they're all still going, Pop XTC. Well, yeah. Anyway, we'll talk about all that later in the show as we delve into OMD's past, discover their favourite holy grails of electronic music, and hear their own take on that massively fertile late 70s Northwest scene. Yes, I'm lumping Liverpool and Manchester in together, that produced them and fantastic bands from the Bonnie Men to Joy Division. If you're new to Big Mouth and you're an OMD fan, hello and welcome. We are here every week talking about what's really interesting in pop culture, from music and movies to telly and everything beyond. You can subscribe to us on your favourite podcast app. There's about 150 past episodes up there covering everything from brand new Netflix to ancient rave. And if you really like the show, you can support us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Pledges are £5 a month and you'll get the show a day early when it comes out. Pledges are £10 every month and you'll get a Big Mouth mug too. Regular listeners, there's no extra bit this week, but it's going to resume next week. So before we take Andy and Paul back to the days of higher purchase and build your own synth, let's refresh our memory with possibly OMD's biggest worldwide hit, Enola Gay. I say that was your biggest hit. Was it actually your biggest hit? Because in my mind, it was one of the bigger things.
It was a massive hit. I mean, it was.
That was the one that kind of kicked the doors open for us internationally.
And yet, it wasn't on the album at first, was it? It was kind of an interim, you know.
Well, it was actually kicking around when we did the first album, but we hadn't finished it, had we?
It was the first song that was written by one of us and not both of us.
Yes, that's true.
Right. So it was a bit contentious. I mean, Paul and I had both taken a year off. I'd taken a gap year out of going to university, and he hadn't told his mother he'd been offered a job at BT and refused
in
to
London.
Take it.
Because it meant leaving
Liverpool.
She
would have killed him if he had. Yeah. If she found out. But we always used to work round at Paul's house because his mum was working 6 days a week, so that was the place that it was quiet to go and make noise. And after Paul had turned down about... six or seven compulsory job offers from the Dole office.
Yeah.
Because we were both on the Dole. They finally said, if you don't take the next one, we're going to stop
the Dole.
So he had to go out working at repairing the local swimming pool, which was outdoors. So Paul Humphreys carrying a hod in January was a fairly amusing sight.
I was laying concrete in the snow, you know.
But whilst he was doing that, I was round at his mum's house writing Enola Gay on my own.
Yeah.
And so that was a bit difficult, I think, because Paul didn't feel like it was his baby. But our manager at the time, who was only our manager because he owned the tape recorder and drove the van, thought it was pop crap and said, I'm leaving if you release this rubbish.
Wow.
Did he leave?
Strangely enough, no.
No.
After it was an enormous hit.
We fired him in the end, actually. Yeah.
I mean, you both met at primary school in Mells on the Wirral. And the Wirral is not really known as the sort of industrial wasteland that's supposed to produce electronic music. Apart from Stanlow, obviously you did a tune in tribute to the old refinery at Stanlow.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it that got you in? I mean, the story that you know, Kraftwerk, obviously, is a huge thing. But was that originally what got you into electronic music and wanting to make it? Were there earlier things too?
No, I mean, I think hearing Autobahn on the radio... when it was released, was an incredible eye-opener. There was a whole new world had just opened up. This, you know, they sounded like the future. We were kind of a bit disenchanted with rock music and all the rock and roll cliches. We were looking for an alternative music. I mean, punk was seen as an alternative music, but that was after we discovered Kraftwerk, so we'd found our alternative before punk came around.
You wanted the alternative to the alternative.
Yeah.
Did you go to the famous Kraftwerk gig at Liverpool Empire? That literally everybody in Liverpool of a certain age. I was there.
Yeah, I did, and Paul didn't, because Paul was only 15 and his mum wouldn't let him out on Sunday night.
I couldn't. Yeah, well, I wasn't allowed to go to gigs until I was 16.
Oh.
So I forgave her in the end.
God. What are your memories of it, Andy?
I sat in seat Q36.
Wow. You still got the ticket?
I haven't got the ticket. It was basically, it was the nearest seat I could get in the stalls to the front without being the full price tickets. So it was the next price down. But yeah, interestingly enough, everybody, it's like the Sex Pistols at the Free Trade Hall. Everybody claims they saw the gig, but I remember the place being empty.
Really?
Yeah, it was empty. But it was, yeah, it was the first day of the rest of my life. And unfortunately, Wolfgang Fleur seems to recall that I came and knocked on the dressing room door and said, "I'm throwing away my guitars and we're going to start a band called OMD and play synths."
Rubbish. Now,
I had to get the train home because it was school the next day. I did not go and knock on the door. But it was the first day of the rest of my life. I mean, listen, it was 75. You know, it was the era of long hair and flared trousers and boring lead guitar solos. Mm-hmm. These guys came out with slick hair, suits, two of them playing, you know, tea trays with electronic knitting needles, and I was just blown away.
It was a total antithesis of rock and roll, you know.
No, which is what they wanted to be, you know, absolutely everything that Anglo-American rock wasn't. But the problem was that, you know, the good thing about Paul and I was I would buy the records with my Sunday paper round money. and he had a stereo that he built himself because I only had my mum's old Dansette from like 1950-something. So it was.
That was how
the relationship worked. I would go round to his house. We wanted to do something kind of weird and interesting electronic. The problem was, I just bought myself a bass guitar that was left-handed with my 16th birthday money, and he had nothing. So we were hamstrung with how we were going to be the future of electronic music.
With a bass.
One bass guitar, and basically he cannibalised his auntie's radios for the circuits to build things.
Wow.
Yeah, we called noise-making machines because they didn't actually have a keyboard, but they used to make, you know, great oscillator noises, and we used to process them through echo units and things. It wasn't until we got a little Selmer Pianotron and a Vox Jaguar organ. That was when we could start actually, you know, adding proper music to our noises.
Wow. So that's interesting because I always thought there was a sort of a nostalgic a bit like, we're going to talk more about Kraftwerk later, a little bit like the world of Radioactivity, where you're sort of looking back to the past. And if it's like, you know, cheap organs and, you know, HP keyboards kind of thing, that gives it that other dimension.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, we didn't, because we're two working-class boys in Liverpool, no money, you know, we kind of, as kids, we wanted to be Kraftwerk, but, you know, we just didn't have the resources to have that access to that technology. Yeah. So we had to be sort of junk shop Kraftwerk, really.
So you deliberately chose a pretentious name, a great big long name with loads of vowels in it, and the Smiths later called themselves the Smiths because of the great big long pretentious name. They wanted an antidote to that. Yeah. Did you want, you know, how much did you want to set yourself apart from, I mean, you were just mentioning now, Andy, you know, the kind of the real man, long hair, hairy man rock.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of it was when we finally dared ourselves to go on stage to do this one-off gig at Eric's Club in Liverpool, we wanted a name that said, you know, this is not punk, this is not rock, this is not pop or disco, this is something different. And we deliberately chose the most preposterous un-rock and roll name we could think of. But, you know, to be honest, we weren't alone in Liverpool. Mm. Echo and the Bunnymen, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, The Teardrop Explodes, Flock of Seagulls. You know,
Dalek, I mean, I Love You.
Dalek, I Love You, yeah. I mean, Wirral's other finest synth band.
There's another one? Okay, right. No, you were in them, weren't you, for a while? Dalek.
They were looking for a singer and
I felt abandoned.
He was.
They were good as well. I felt abandoned.
Great
from
band.
Hoy Lake.
Yeah. Yes. From Hoy Lake.
That was the summer of 78.
He soon came back to me.
I did a couple of gigs with them and then realised that I actually wanted to do our own song. So that's kind of one of the other reasons why we decided to get up on stage and do our own thing. And it was a preposterous name, but it certainly it really wasn't going to last 40 years. It was only going to be for one night.
And yet 40 years later, I still can't spell manoeuvres. Yeah, I have to just like,
most Americans can't either.
Yeah. Mm. So I'm putting your first thing out on Factory, because the rivalry between Liverpool and Manchester, you know, existed then and persists to an extent. What was it like working with Wilson and all those guys?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, we were the outsiders for Liverpool, really. We were known as the Woollybacks because we came from the other side of the Mersey. So we weren't really accepted as a Liverpool band in the Liverpool scene, even though we were, you know, always at Eric's, playing Eric's. And we're a bit of the outsiders in Manchester because, you know, we weren't from Manchester. So we're always kind of the outsiders. But it was amazing to get on Factory. I mean, it was a complete stroke of luck. I mean, after the first gig, we were invited to play just one more gig at the Factory Club in Manchester. And that was where we met Tony Wilson. Mm. And we cheekily gave him a cassette with Electricity on it. We'd just done this demo, you know, on a cassette. We didn't know he was starting Factory Records. We just wanted to get on his TV show because he was the presenter of Granada Reports and he had local bands on there. So we handed him a cassette to cheekily try to get on the TV. And it ended up in a bag of cassettes in Tony Wilson's car.
Reject cassettes.
And his wife was going through this bag and pulled something out and said, "Oh, Castro Mirror's the Dark. Let's listen to that." And Tony didn't really get it. Mm. He'd seen us play and he hadn't really got it. But his wife said, "You've got to sign this band. They're amazing. You know, they'll be big."
Have you seen the Factory exhibition at the Chelsea Space at Tottenham? Because you're in it. It's the first 50 FAC numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Electricity is in there. And it's a fantastic... It captures that world of, you know, anti-London, but also kind of deliberately kind of austere and grey and setting yourself apart from the kind of hypercolor world of pop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it was... That came from several different strands. Obviously, the bands on Factory were all from the Northwest. Mm. Peter Saville's design was very kind of art school graphic and minimal. So again, that set it aside from the kind of flowery, you know, the pretty people on the front of the album sleeve kind of thing. And of course, the lyrics weren't all about, you know, "Ooh, I love you and you love me." It was quite austere lyrics as well. They, you know, we were reflecting, if only unconsciously, we were reflecting the environment.
Yeah. Did you feel that your first album and also organisation were kind of still Factory Records? They felt like Factory Records. They looked like Factory Records. They had that, you know, way of looking at the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think organisation particularly was quite influenced by Joy Division, I think, because we made it after we did a lot of shows with Joy Division and after we'd sort of fallen in love with their music. So it definitely... that sort of more dark kind of gothic sound came into the organisation album, I think. Do you think? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the first album was basically all the songs we'd written between the ages of 16 and 19 and recorded in our own studio very badly. So it had that kind of like, you know, synth garage punk vibe to it. And then, yeah, the second one, absolutely the more dark gothic sound that we'd fallen in love with from Joy Division's records. Yeah.
Well, there was a big turning point with Architecture and Morality in 1983, where you got more orchestral, more lush and more kind of painterly, maybe. And as every pub quiz knows, there's only one band that got two songs about a heroine of Catholicism into the charts, and it was you. Where did the Joan of Arc diptych come from? Where did your painted Russian icon, two songs about Joan of Arc, where did that develop from?
A diptych is always better than a dick pic. We were touring in France in early 1981. And the support band, who were French, said, "Oh, this is like the Joan of Arc history tour. You know, you're playing in Rouen and Orléans and all these places associated with it." That planted the seed in my head. And being the kind of geek I am, I would research stuff and I went to the library and got loads of books out on Joan of Arc and made notes. I want to write a song called Joan of Arc. I actually wrote the waltz version first, Maid of Orléans. Didn't think it was working, so put it aside and then wrote Joan of Arc. Just happened to be on the day of the 550th anniversary of the English burning her to death. And then the day we were packing up to go to the Manor Studios to record Architecture and Morality, Paul and Malcolm came in and went, "So which ones are we recording?" And we went through the list and they said, "Yeah, but what about that waltzy one?" I said, "No, this doesn't work." And Mal said, "Well, if you let me play drums on it, it will." So we were like, "All right, well, we'll try it when we get to the studio." So essentially, I was determined to write a song about Joan of Arc. binned the first one. And then these boys said, no, let's have a go at that one. So we had two. They were both called Joan of Arc. And then the record company said, well, you'll have to call one like the Waltz Joan of Arc or something. And then, of course, when it came to release them as singles, I thought this would be great fun. Let's have two consecutive singles called with the same name.
People might buy it twice by mistake. Four copies in the end, yes.
Well, no, this was the record company's angle, which was quite the reverse. It's like, no, people will think they've already bought it, so you can't call it the same thing. But what's funny is, particularly in Europe, actually, Maid of Orleans, the waltz version, which we weren't going to do, was
became
a massive
hit.
In fact, Joan of Arc wasn't released in Europe because Souvenir was in the charts for so long. We skipped that one in Europe. When people say Joan of Arc, they mean Maid of Orleans. Yeah. So it's, it's still confusing all these
years. It was a big hit in the UK.
Yeah. Well, let's have a listen to it. This is Joan of Arc, Maid of Orleans, not Maid of Orleans, as I've been calling it for years.
Or New Orleans.
New Orleans.
Maid of New Orleans, yeah.
You need to do your boogie-woogie third version with Maid of Orleans. Anyway, here we go. So it's often said that you sort of sabotage yourself a bit afterwards with the tape experiments on Dazzle Ships, mentioned, ABC Auto Industry and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there are bangers.
Bet you're not going to play that, are you?
No, probably not.
Why not?
Keep going. ABC.
One, two, three.
Has anybody ever done a cappella OMD? We've just invented
that. I think we just have.
I mean, there are bangers on that album. There's Genetic Engineering and Telegraphs on there. I think I remember you doing ABC Auto Industry on the Tube.
We did, flags. Yes. With flags, yeah.
Was that the most out there you got on television?
I think it was. We really pushed the boundaries there.
You should have seen the look on the audience faces. They were like, what the hell?
Well, they did actually keep cutting to the audience, so I think we got a good look at them. Yeah.
And Mal, our drummer, just kept saying, are you sure this is the right thing to do on the Tube? Said, yeah, it's a great idea. Honestly, it's bonkers, but it's a great...
The thing is, we had spent our entire musical career, which was, all of four or five years up to that point. But we'd done three albums completely doing what we wanted and changing style every album. And the record company just let us get on with it because they were like, well, we don't understand what they do, but they go away, they write songs and they come back with weird stuff and it sells millions, so they must know what they're doing. And we naturally just moved into another place. But this time, I think we got a little bit too stripped, a little bit too conceptual, and we didn't kind of cover all the tunes in the sugar coating of the melodies and the choirs. And we were just a bit more than 15 minutes ahead of the fashion this time, and it collapsed commercially. We lost 90% of our sales from Architectural Morality to Dazzle Ships. But now, all these years later, Dazzle Ships is considered to be the seminal classic piece, and we keep meeting people who go, oh, that album changed my life. Oh, that album influenced me.
Even people like Radiohead and The Killers cite it as a really important album to them.
It gets a lot of quietus love these days. The quietus are very fond of art tape experience. You've talked about Kraftwerk and things like that, but were Radiophonic Workshop ever a thing for you? Some cut-ups and things like that?
I mean, who doesn't love the Doctor Who theme tune and all the weird sounds they used to make? But I don't...
Yeah.
I think the thing for us is we liked to experiment to channel ourselves and challenge ourselves and to see what we could make out of things that shouldn't be music. But we don't like experiments for their own sake, just left as experiments. We actually like musicality. So the trick is to start somewhere weird and then see if you can wrestle it into something melodic.
And that's kind of the way we work. I mean, we always start with a mad idea. And some get more sort of commercial sounding by the end of us experimenting with them than others. And so they're the singles.
There's a CD in your enormous box set of the bits, the hidden bits, the unfinished stuff, the experiments, that kind of thing. Is that the alternative OMD that would never have gone? We need to turn this into Talking Loud and Clear.
Well, yeah, in a way. I mean, you can actually hear these tracks and go, because they're all dated, so you can relate them to the albums around that time when we did them, and you can see where we were, you know, what we were thinking, where we were going. But that was a really interesting thing to do. I mean, I went to there's a massive archive near Heathrow, and it's an amazing place. And I went in there for 2 days and just went through all, because all of our tapes, everything we've ever recorded is in there. And so I had an amazing couple of days going through all of these tapes, trying to find things that we'd sort of started but abandoned. And it was a great journey, actually.
I mean, there are about eight tracks songs, on there as well, which just never got released. But yeah, as Paul said, I mean, this, we would use the tape as a writing tool. We would just throw down 4 or 5 minutes of something and then see if that would inspire us to then develop it. And it's a bit like, you know, painting, you know, sizing your canvas and then blocking in the trees and a bit, and then hoping it would get to some finished version.
Almost like sampling. Yeah. You're getting the atmosphere of something and then you're seeing how you can structure
it. That's right, yes.
Exactly.
After Dazzleswitch, you went for the brass ring, as it were. You really went for the pop success and to try. Had it been a bit of an alarm bell?
Well, alarm bells were ringing, because, as Andy said, we lost 90% of our audience. But by this time, we'd actually bought houses. We had, people on the payroll, crew and all these people relying on us for their living. And all of a sudden, we'd kind of crashed the business. So we did have to kind of try to get back on track. And so, in hindsight, we did kind of abandon the experiments a bit more and concentrated on getting some hit singles again.
Although, I mean, OK, there's Locomotion, Tesla Girls and Talking Loud and Clear on the John Carter album, but there's still some pretty odd stuff on.
Oh, yeah, there is, yeah.
As electronic music people, did you see, because it looked from the outside like being in OMD was getting to be harder work, as you sort of had to sort of, maybe sort of,
Well, as the 80s went on, it did get harder work.
Yeah. Were you looking at, what was happening with, house music and raving and think, that's kind of part of our world and part not?
That didn't come till the end of the 80s, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, the biggest pressure upon us was, as we've touched on it, it was like, OK, this is actually how we pay the bills, so we better actually sell some records next time around. But also, one of the dilemmas we had was that we had signed a record contract when we were 19 that was appalling. The royalties were terrible. And we didn't get into the business in order to make money. But as Paul said, you need to pay the bills, otherwise it stops. And so with all the recording costs and the tour support, because we were touring around America, trying to break America, but it was breaking us and breaking the bank. And so we'd get to the end of 9 months on the road, and our accountant and managers would go, you're skint, you need a record now. And so instead of taking time to let the well of inspiration refill, we were having to go into the studio and literally in 6 weeks, the first 10 things we wrote, good, bad or otherwise, that was the album, regardless, because we had no time to really be editorial. And so that was where the pressure was coming from, really.
There was a kind of a natural ending, eventually, wasn't it? Because Paul, you left first, and then Andy did a few more albums and kind of wound it up for an interregnum, during which time you did Atomic Kitten. Which is what?
Can you rephrase that?
Well, much time.
When you say "did Atomic Kitten,"
created Svengali'd. I mean, that was one of the most surprising things ever connected with your kind of bands of your background. Did you do it as a kind of an intellectual experiment? Can I do this?
Oh, I'd love to say that. Yes. it was my ironic art concept program. No, I'll tell you what. You're wearing a Kraftwerk T-shirt.
Yes.
Kraftwerk invented Atomic Kitten.
Okay, substantiate.
I became good friends and musical work partner with Carl Bartos. And he worked with me on the last album I did on my own in the 90s, the Universal album. And we did some co-writing together. And when it became obvious that, in the mid-90s, after grunge and Britpop, and we'd entered the postmodern era where guitars were back in fashion, and a band perceived as an 80s synth band was banging its head against a brick wall. I said, oh, I'll give up, but I'm conceited enough to still think I can write songs, but the vehicle is past its sell-by date. I think I'm just going to give songs to my publishers. Carl Bartos said to me, no, don't do that. You're just whoring your songs. They'll mess around with them. You won't get any credit. It'll be horrible. I said, well, what do I do? He said, create a vehicle. So I said, like what? He said, well, what's the best pop group ever? I said, girl bands are the best pop groups because boy bands get away with murder because teenage girls are not only made blind by love but also deaf. So boy bands chart with appalling crap, and we all know it.
Absolutely true.
Whereas girl bands, no girl band ever had a hit with a lousy song because people buy them on merit. So I said, girl band, three-piece girl band like the Supremes or Bananarama, that's the vehicle. So Carl Bartos from Kraftwerk said, wow, create a three-piece girl band.
Blimey. And so ultimately Kraftwerk invented Kerry Katona by extension.
By extension. It's stretching it a bit, but...
Yeah, like two K's in both names.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're back together. I mean, you're back together now. You know, OMD is a thriving concern.
In fact, we're back together now for longer than when we were together the first...
Well, I was going to say, because it's like...
The first incarnation.
Yeah, so it's like, what, 12 or 13 years back in the
13 years, yeah.
Your kind of route to get back together was through the, like, let's just play an album in its entirety, kind of one-off, so let's do a special, like, let's do Coachella. When did you realise you'd actually re-signed and it was now full-time again?
Well, what happened was we got... as the millennium passed, there was more interest in electronic music again, and so the phone started going, you know, people were getting interested in OMD again. And so because Andy was doing Atomic Kitten and I was doing other things, I was working with Cloudy Brook in Propaganda.
Yes.
And it was never quite the right time to look at the possibility of getting OMD back together. And so it got to 2005, and, you know, the phone was still ringing to get us to do things. Someone from a German TV show called Andy and said, you know, The Maid of Orleans was, you know, the biggest hit in 1982, and we're doing a TV show celebrating the biggest hits of all the years. Will you come and perform? And so Andy, instead of saying no, as we kept saying to everyone, Andy phoned me and said, you fancy a jolly to Cologne, and we'll spend a weekend together and get, you know, see each other again, because I lived in London, he lived in Liverpool, we never really saw each other very much. So yeah, we just did this TV show, and we had such a good time doing it that we thought, you know, could we possibly do this again? And so we decided to put 9 shows on sale, and those 9 shows sold out, and it turned into 49 shows, and then all of a sudden we were back doing it again.
Mm. Is it better now that you're kind of your own bosses and your own kind of...
I think I'm having more fun doing it now than I did in the 80s. I mean, the 80s was amazing.
Mm.
We did
intense.
Some great things, but it was very intense.
We were living on our nerves. And also, we never intended to be a successful pop group. This is a 40-year rolling accident.
It actually is.
We're not complaining, we're blessed. But, you know, because we never intended or aspired to it, it was always quite difficult to keep hanging on to the kind of the tail of this crazy horse that was leading us into places we didn't expect to go.
Blimey. We'll be back in 10 years' time, you'll still be saying the same thing.
Probably.
But, you know, the really great thing is now is after a couple of years of being reformed and playing gigs, then we asked ourselves the question, are we just a tribute band to ourselves? Because this isn't our raison d'etre.
Yeah.
You know, we created the band in order to do new things and challenge ourselves and experiment. Can we actually do that again? Because that is what we should be doing if we can. And that was quite dangerous because, you know, there's a lot of bands of a certain generation who should not be allowed back in a studio. They're lazy. They've run out of ideas. All they want is just a new logo for the next tour's T-shirt.
Or there are bands who are too scared to do it. I mean, Ralph Hutter is a prime example.
Yeah.
He's too scared to make a new record because he doesn't want to diminish his legacy.
Yeah.
So it was dangerous to do it, but we felt we had to do it. But actually, the 3 albums we've made since we reformed have essentially contemporized us you know, people, in fact, a lot of people said to me, oh, the last three albums and the first four were great, which made us go, oh, so the middle 35 years was rubbish.
Yeah, I know, really.
But Atomic Kitten are good. Yeah.
I right. noticed you didn't ask him if he did Claudia Brooken.
Well,
we'll be getting on.
It's a very good record, that.
Actually did, but anyway.
Whoops!
We took another 16 years.
Okay, right, let's take a small detour. Shame, really. We are always ask our guests to bring in a track they love, and why not carry on with that? Andy McCluskey, you're half weird electronics and half weird pop. What contemporary tune have you brought in?
I am still like I was when I was a kid. I hate most things I hear. They do not talk to me. Mm-hmm. They don't resonate in any way, shape or form. It's kind of noise pollution. But just occasionally I'll hear something contemporary that makes me go, wow, like I did when I first heard Out of Barn as a kid. And some of the early Lady Gaga songs were so fabulously kind of electro and dysfunctional. And she made these wonderfully bonkers videos. And I was just absolutely besotted. So I think Bad Romance, and it's such a great lyric as well. It's so wrong, it's right. Mm. So Bad Romance is one of those, you know, recent, for me, classics that's just different and special.
OK, let's hear it. There is never a bad time to play this. It's Lady Gaga and Bad Romance. And you know that I need you.
Now, while we're on favourites, OMD are an electronic band with a capital E, so we thought we'd force them to choose their favourite electronic albums. And to our amazement, here's what they came up with. They both chose the same one. It's the Holy Grail. It's the original source. We mentioned them a little bit earlier. It's Radioactivity by Kraftwerk.
Choosing Kraftwerk is the least surprising thing ever.
Are we that predictable?
And the same album as well.
The same album.
So I don't know, do you still go back to it? Did you play it this morning? Did you play it last night?
I do listen to it regularly.
Do you?
I
sleep.
Yeah.
On in the background.
Oh. It's for us. You see, the thing is, we got turned on to Kraftwerk when we heard Autobahn, but Autobahn was a year late being a hit. So when I went to the concert that his mother wouldn't let him go to...
You're still rubbing it in, you see that?
Yeah, I know. I was there and you weren't.
Yeah. I promise you it'll be the last time I mention that right. I went to Kraftwerk and you didn't. The thing was, radio. They were actually doing the Radioactivity tour.
Right.
Now, Autobahn... as an album was pretty good. It was a kind of, but it was a kind of like electronic tone poems. Mm. They were actually trying to use electronics to recreate the sense of other things like Mitternacht and driving
Spaziergang.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the Radioactivity album was much more conceptual. And the one thing that we learned, if anything, from that album is that anything can be music if you believe it has a musicality. Mm. And all of the songs on that album were interspersed with these snippets of, like, radios and Geiger counters and just things that weren't necessarily going to be considered music concrete.
Yes.
So they taught us to think like that.
It was our blueprint, really, that record.
Had you ever heard anything like it before?
Well, no, that was
not
the thing.
Not liked we're it.
Yeah. I mean, the great thing about Kraftwerk was that they were, you know, they were conceptual, they were experimental, But laced in with those experiments was a great tune. They were just great at writing melodies. And we also took that as a major blueprint, you know, none of the songs had vocal choruses. And if you think back to all our early songs, so many of the choruses are actually keyboard melodies with us. You know, like Electricity, Enola Gay, Souvenir, Maid of Orleans, they're all keyboard-driven choruses.
One of the beautiful things about the Radioactivity album, obviously there's, you know, the very obvious double meaning, it's both, you know, Radioactive Decay, but also the kind of nostalgic love of radio itself and transmission and connection and in places that had never been connected before. There is a huge nostalgic thing to it, isn't there? That seems inherent in electronic music, you know, looking back to a time that's gone somehow.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing about Kraftwerk is they didn't look like rock stars, but if you look at them now, neither did they look like suit-wearing bankers in the 70s. They actually looked like people from the 40s or the 30s.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that their kind of utopian vision of a future of electronics and computers and robots, looking at it positively, was this immediate post-war sense that science is going to resolve all of our problems and we'll all have, you know, great healthcare and we'll be going to work in a flying car. And it was this kind of utopian vision of the future that was actually quite nostalgic.
Yeah.
And, of course, we started off with that idea as well, but then it becomes a kind of, you start to realise that actually it's quite dystopian that people don't use the technology always for good. That's why we write, you know, Enola Gay, or about an oil refinery with a rather ambivalent, melancholy sense to it. That, yeah, we all drive cars, but what about the pollution in the air and in the ground? So I think that kind of sense of, like, a nostalgia for a future that was optimistic but never really arrived, it is imbued in a lot of electronic music from that time.
Their records, though, could still sound like they were made last week, couldn't they? There's an element about them. Am I
with
right? They still sound fresh.
They still sound contemporary, I think.
So people have adopted their sounds and ideas, but done different things with them. They had a very, very pure way of doing things, uncompromising way of doing things.
That weren't time-stamped either.
They weren't time-stamped. But it's in the same way that, you know, you take a lot of people to an art gallery and show them a Mondrian or a Picasso and they'll go, I don't like modern art. It's 100 years old. It's still bloody modern.
That's true.
There's another interesting thing about Kraftwerk as well, is that they basically, it's like they're trying to rescue Germanness, aren't they? It's like, what would it be like to be German if the war hadn't happened?
It's just the
beauty and nostalgia for it, you know, before it all went horribly wrong. And they are of that generation, the first generation, to have to deal with their parents and their grandparents, which is, again, it's massively poignant, isn't it?
There's the idea that the robot is cleansing, isn't it? It cleanses the past, and then you look to the future as you're saying.
Let's just turn the podcast over to an old Kraftwerk format.
The other thing was that obviously Florian Schneider's father was an architect who was responsible for a lot of the brand new buildings in the flattened Germany post-war. And also, you know, Dusseldorf didn't look anything like the Dusseldorf that their parents had grown up in. But they were also trying to be desperately and absolutely not Anglo-American rock cliché. And that's why we loved it, because as teenagers, we were looking for something different as well. And that's why we resonated with their music.
Right. Paul, it's your turn to choose a tune. What current favourite? And we're stretching the definition of current.
Yeah, it's not that current, but it's still...
It'll do. What
sounds current. I'm a big Arcade Fire fan. And a few years ago, they released Reflector. And I'm like Andy, really. So much stuff doesn't resonate with me. Singles. I hear the singles chart and I'm fraught. You know, because I think, God, it's just not speaking to me. It's not speaking to me. And when they released that song, Reflector, it hit me. You know, what an amazing song that is.
All bands need to go disco at a crucial point, particularly rock bands. Remember in the 70s when rock bands would be basically frog-marched into going disco? And often it was great. This has got Bowie on it as well, hasn't it?
It's one of Bowie's last collaborations he did.
Here we go, let's have a listen. It's Reflector, with a K, heavy on the Ks this week, by Arcade Fire.
laughter.
Finally, earlier I mentioned the Factory Records retrospective exhibition Use Hearing Protection, currently on at the Chelsea Space in London. And one of the exhibits is a poster for a gig called Zoo Meets Factory Halfway, a one-day festival in Lee in Lancashire on the 27th of August 1979. It's got its own factory number, FAC 15. The Liverpool and Manchester are famous rivals. Bands from both cities played on a bill that contained, get this, Echo and the Bunnymen, A Certain Ratio, The Teardrop Explodes, Joy Division and Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark. It looks like my iPod. Perhaps rather...
inside of your brain.
It's the inside of my brain. Perhaps rather than a Manchester and Liverpool scene, there was one scene, a big flowering of a certain kind of music at the end of the 70s and the 80s. Andy and Paul, what can you remember from this very strange day?
That no down, one showed up.
Really?
There's hardly anyone there. I mean, for all those bands, it was an empty field, wasn't it?
It was an empty field. I think there was 250 turned up and they were expecting 5,000. I remember somebody reviewed it because they listed this band you've just said, you know, in years to come, you couldn't get this lot on Reading in one bill or, you know, and yet nobody turned up.
And yet, if you put that on now, obviously there's certain bands you possibly couldn't put on. Be a bit of a trick to put Joy Division on. But if you were to do that now, it would, you know, 5,000 wouldn't be anywhere near enough, would it?
No.
I remember thinking, oh, you know, we've come all this way and look at this. I also remember I'd planned that it might rain and I was on stage and I was in a thin shirt and I was wearing a plastic Mac and it was typical sensible. English summer. The plastic Mac was bloody freezing. I was actually getting chilled from the coat I was wearing.
I find a quote on this from Christoph from the band Crawling Chaos. You don't get mentioned anywhere near enough. He said, my abiding memory is of dozens of badly dressed northerners all trying to outcool each other.
Which, yeah, that kind of sums it up as well, really.
That's basically the music scene in the entire Northwest, though. Well, it always has been. And somebody else said there was a joke among the bands. It's your turn to be the audience now while we get up and play. Well, the reason I raise it is because we asked you for the band of your contemporaries that you liked the most and admired the most. And you said it was Joy Division.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was a thing about them that was... that was beyond what other people were doing. When did you first encounter Joy Division?
Well, we thought we'd encountered them on our first gig, but in the process of researching books and things for our 40th anniversary, we've detonated our own creation myth.
Yeah.
Our first gig was not with Joy Division. It was with another JD artist on Factory, John Dowie, the comedian.
But we played with them, like fourth gig, I think, something like
that. Yeah, we played with them a lot. Obviously, once we'd signed and did Electricity, we played several concerts with them. And it was...
Well, we kind of fell in love with their sound, really.
Yeah. But the thing was, Martin Hannett took their playing and sculpted it into a particular sound that I don't think... Well, I mean, if you read their books, they were like, we hated it. We didn't like what he did to us. But he had isolated in them Stephen Morris's particular way of drumming, Hookie's bass lines, obviously Ian's amazing, dark, you know, literature-driven vocals. And then he took the guitar, which is the mainstay of most rock music, made it smaller and put it in the corners as little colours. And that's not... Barney hated the first record. Yeah.
He wanted to make a rock record.
Yeah. But they had... He taught them a slightly different sound, and then they adopted it, and then they went even deeper on the Closer album. And it was just... They were amazing, but they were, like us, they were ordinary working-class northern kids who... I can remember somebody interviewing them and writing a piece for one of the Inky papers who didn't understand how these guys, who smoked cigarettes, drank beer, talked about girls and football, had made this beautiful dark art album. And he thought, it's not really them. It's been manufactured by Tony Wilson, Peter Saville and Martin Hannett. They're just puppets. No.
No, it was
They were
really
ordinary
them.
Lads, but they did this stuff. They thanked this. They thought this way. They created this music. And I think that's what we were trying to do. That's what a Certain Ratio were trying... Just working class lads who, you know, we sat in our bedrooms looking at the rain and walking through the slums to school and thinking, we want to do something else. We want to dream and aspire, but in a rather dark and messed up way.
Well, they encapsulated that kind of northern dark kind of spirit that we all had. And they put that to music, you know, and Ian's lyrics were just absolutely stunning.
I did nose around on YouTube, where everything in the world can be found now. And there are recordings of them on at the show in Lee in August 1979. And although it's not recorded in the best possible way, they do sound like Black Sabbath. It's big guitars and it's a lot of kind of very brutal energy. And it's not what you get on Unknown Pleasures. It's kind of, and there is a school of thought that goes, there should have been another Joy Division, which were that kind of reinvented enormous rock in a way that real Joy Division kind of reinvented kind of post-punk art music. Can you remember seeing them at Lee? I mean, I realise it's 40 years ago. Did you see this band?
Do you know what? No, do you know what? Really. It was such a crap day and so cold. We packed our stuff up and left. But you see, we'd seen them before, so it wasn't like, you know, oh, you know, we've got to better see this band because their singer will be dead soon. It was just like, oh, you know.
Yeah, it's raining.
It's raining, we're cold. Let's leave. Let's
probably should have stayed to sort of double the number of the crowd, you know.
That's four of you then.
There is a famous photograph that you can find online of us on stage, and there are more bins in the field than there are human beings.
Insane.
Bit in audience. I mean, finally, just before we start to wrap the show up, I mean, if you told Andy and Paul back then that in 40 years' time, A, it would still be going, the accident would still be continuing.
Yeah.
They'd have had huge hits around the world, they'd been big around the world, you'd split up, you got back together, and you'd still be doing it. That people would still be interested in the things you can find in a Heathrow archive of your old stuff, your doodles. What do you think they would have said?
I think it would be twofold, really. I think part of us would be horrified that we'd still be doing it at the ripe old age of 60.
Young people should do it because old people were boring.
Yeah, we were quite ageist, really.
Rock was ageist then. I mean,
we were looking at the Rolling Stones when we were sort of in our 20s, and we're thinking, they're still doing it, but they must have been, what, in their
late 30s,
and they shouldn't be allowed to be making rock music at their age, you know.
But electronic music has become its own kind of folk music as well, hasn't it? Because you see, you know, younger bands, as you say, you know, they want the original synthesizers, they want you know, the equivalent of the hand-carved lute. They want the original kind of Korg or Prophet or whatever. It's now developed its own culture.
Yeah.
And off what the sort of downside of that is often that you sort of feel the need to, regurgitate or reinvent things in the past rather
reverence.
Than... Reverence.
Rather than experiment.
So when you look at the
important thing is to... I mean, we have our own sound and we'd be stupid to throw that away because it's sound we created by chance, by accident. So we have a certain mentality and palette that it happens by accident. We just sit down and write songs and say, oh, it sounds like OMD. Yeah, because we wrote it.
Yeah, it's got our signature all over it, you know.
But we desperately don't want to just be a sad pastiche of ourselves. But I think the second thing Paul was going to say was... If our younger selves had listened to English Electric and The Punishment to Luxury, they might have gone, actually, wow, I'm still doing cool music. Okay, you can carry on.
Yeah, carry on.
We would definitely have been proud of the last two records that we've done, no doubt.
Okay, let's TARDIS back to 1979 for a bit of Joy Division. This is Shadow Play. Now, there's another great band from Wirral, Half Man, Half Biscuit. Mm-hmm. How did you feel when they released Architecture and Morality and Ted and Alice as a track? You must be aware of this classic of the genre.
better than if they'd done, you know, If There Is a God, Why Is There OMD?
Very good answer.
It's a, you know, if you've made it into the canon, it's a compliment. You're etched on the Half Man, Half Bucket War Memorial there. We're coming to the end of this special edition of Big Mouth, which means it's closing time chatter. And as ordinarily we talk about things that are happening in the world around us, but we haven't recommended that many things to watch, listen and see on this show. So we thought we'd get some ideas from the guests, yes, as well as me and Sean. Andy McCluskey, what are you enjoying on the tour bus? What have you been absorbing?
I am notorious for not watching television. I used to watch news, but now I want to throw my shoe at the TV, understandably. On the tour bus, I actually fall asleep with my headphones in, listening to audiobooks, specifically history audiobooks. Mm-hmm. So I've been listening to things like Yuval Noah Harari's Sapiens, yeah, various Bill Bryson's History of Everything in the World. That's what I do. I fall asleep to information.
And that sounds like a lyric, actually. Write that one down, yeah. I fall asleep to information. Sapiens is really good, though, isn't it? Because it enables, it's more than a history of human culture, it's a history of human minds and how the mind functions.
I think the most interesting fact for me was this whole thing about humans had to create a mental capacity to go from being small family groups and tribes to functioning as large civilizations. And the only way to do it was to create these fictions. Mm. And this, for me, was the most relevant part of that, that money is a fiction, religion is a fiction, nations are a fiction. You all agree to things, but it's actually a fiction. Mm. It's an agreed concept rather than a reality.
Yeah, he's very big on it. Humans being a storytelling species that tell themselves stories in order to survive. I thought it was fantastic. Paul, how about you?
I end up spending hours going down wormholes on YouTube. I mean, I do. But it's usually like science or astronomy wormholes.
Not
how that goes.
Not makeup tutorials anymore.
So it's either that, or I think I find something on Netflix and I binge watch something on Netflix. And the last thing I binge watched was Stranger Things. Actually, I love that series. Yeah.
Was it just for the synths? It was just for the synths.
Well, the thing I loved about it, well, yeah, the synths are great in it. That's what drew me to it, was the theme tune, actually, because, you know, it's got an 80s vibe to it.
Yeah.
You know, 80s electronica vibe to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic kind of ensemble thing. I mean, I really love the first season, second season less so. But it's
I still enjoyed the second season, but the first season was amazing.
Yeah, and it's kind of pretty sort of truthful about kids.
Exactly. I could totally relate to quite a lot of the characters in there.
When you were listening to the theme and the incidental music, are you thinking, I know how they did that? I know that patch, I know that keyboard.
Yeah, I could recognise a lot of the synths in there, actually. I could name them.
Blimey. Sean, how about you? What's your closing time chat for this week?
I've been listening to Girl Band. Their second album is out. I love them. You know when you're talking about, you just suddenly click into something. Most things just pass you by. You just go, I get this. I need to listen to this on repeat. Their new album is out. It was recorded in a ghostly castle in Ireland. They're a Dublin band and they're fantastic. They have had a 4-year hiatus because the lead singer does have mental health problems and it's really public. It's known. He couldn't deal with it. And it reflects, it's like Samuel Beckett in a ghostly house crossed with The Fall. I would urge everyone to listen to it. It's not easy all the time, but it's deep and it's interesting and it's layered and it's a dissection of rock music. They're taking it apart and they're putting it together again like a sort of acceptable nightmare. It's just amazing.
Acceptable nightmare.
Wow.
Write that one down.
I'm sold, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Please listen. I absolutely love them. And I just want to, I want more people to love
them. I think
we'll
be returning to this subject.
Oh, we must return
in the near future. My recommendation for this week is a book called There's Always Death to Fall Back On by John Moore of Once of the Expressway, of Black Box Recorder, and the great photographer Brian David Stevens. It's a really interesting project where John is dealing with his own kind of mental health issues, really, by writing, you know, poems that could be lyrics, but are, you know, really exist as poetry more than anything else. And Brian photographs him around it. And it's just it's a really sort of powerful and darkly humorous way of dealing with, depression, dealing with reaching certain stages of life where you think there's things you've done and will not be able to get to do them again. And, you know, just to have that ironic title, There's Always Death to Fall Back On, I think that kind of captures it. It's available for sale soon and really worth reading.
if you just want to, you know, stare at a few things that maybe we should all have a look at. And that is the end of the show. Thanks to OMD for coming in. Souvenir is out soon as an enormous box set that will indeed kill a horse and a double CD. Tickets for some dates are still available, but most of them are sold out by the looks of things.
They are mostly sold out, yeah. There's a few tickets here and there, so if you know, check the dates out there, because there may be a few tickets in your area.
Well, I think actually we are releasing a few tickets back that have been held for us for guest lists. So,
so there will be more.
So the,
we're talking about, you know, 2030. So, it's always worth trying a last-minute attempt.
Get your skates on. But what we will be able to say, without question, is you will have got more people into the Liverpool Empire than Kraftwerk did. Because it's sold out.
Absolutely.
Sold out very early, isn't it?
Oh, I mean, it's more than sold out. We've got a guest list of 150 and the support band are from Liverpool as well. So it's like we'll be shoehorning people in.
Who's your support band?
A band called MIG 15, who've got a bass player called James McCluskey.
Oh, right. Okay. So it's like that. Okay.
There's no nepotism in our band, though.
Absolutely not. So
they're bloody brilliant, Mark.
They are amazing.
Well, there you go. Well, get on the ticket list for that. So find yourself a way in. Thanks to Paul and Andy from OMD for coming in. Thanks from me, Sean, and producer Alex Rees for listening. If you're a new listener to Big Mouth, we hope you liked it. Next week, we're going to be talking about the Michael Hutchins biopic Mystify, the new Elbow album Giants of All Sizes, and The Politician on Netflix. And the extra bit will be back for Patreon people too. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite app. In the meantime, let's play out with a dream come true for young musician Andy McCluskey. That time he got to make a record with one of Kraftwerk. You did a track with Carl Bartos's electric music called Kissing the Machine, didn't you? Donkeys years
ago. And then we redid it on our English electric album.
And then you redid it on your English electric album. So here's Andy with electric music and Kissing the Machine, and we'll see you all next week. Cheers then. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.